You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 50 of A Life in Ruins podcast. Reinvestigate the careers of those living a life in ruins. I'm your host, Carlton Gover, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts, David Ian Howe and Connor Johnen. In this episode, we are talking with Dr. Jesse Toon, an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Fort Lewis College. Now, this isn't the first time that Dr. Toon has been a guest on the podcast. He first joined us in episode 37 with Dr. Shane Miller, where we talked about some recent updates on the Cerruti Mastodon site. So we are very excited to have him back on today for a dive into his archaeological career. Good evening, Dr. Toon. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going? Things are going pretty well here. Thanks for having me on again. Nice to hang out with you guys and chat about all things archaeology.
Yeah, and you are a Southern dude as well, and you are now in Colorado, is that right?
That is correct, yeah. From Middle Tennessee originally and moved around all over the place until landed in Colorado.
Okay, yeah. Do you remember meeting me at my field school perchance? I don't know if you remember that far back.
Yeah. Where did we meet? Was it Bell's Bend or Topper?
It was Bell's Bend.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah.
And I was like, who's this dude who looks just like Derek? Because I just saw your ponytail walking by. And Tom Patera, like R.I.P., said, like, get to know that dude. He's really smart. And I was like, oh. And then I think that was the last I saw of you. But yeah, he was right. You are very smart. So where do you currently work? And what is your exact like occupation and, you know, job there?
So right now I'm at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. For hopefully not very much longer, I'm an assistant professor. I'm actually in the middle of my tenure review right now. So hopefully in a few weeks, it'll be associate. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I've been here at Fort Lewis for 6 years now, finishing up my 12th semester. Here at Fort Lewis. Time flies.
Yeah. I remember seeing on Facebook that you moved out there, and I feel like that was a while ago. Yeah. So yeah, checks out.
It's pretty wild. It's the longest I've lived in one place, I think, since I was 18.
Wow.
Well, and Durango is kind of a nice place to live if you can afford it. And besides that ugly highway that runs through the middle of it and makes everything inaccessible.
Yeah, pros and cons. You know, it's living in a vacation town, right?
I just realized all of you guys are in Colorado currently. And
yeah,
it's 80 degrees here in Georgia, so not fun for me.
Dr. Toon. Jesse, your first appearance on episode 37, we talked about the Cerruti Mastodon site, which is a fun site to discuss between archaeologists, especially like-minded ones. Has there been any feedback or that you've received regarding appearing on our podcast a couple of weeks ago?
I've talked to people online, social media, some seen people kind of post and comment about, you know, oh, this is a really, you know, great episode, really great hearing people, you know, talk about this. Yeah, that's about it. Haven't had anyone, I guess, directly kind of contact me and ask me questions or anything about it.
Fair enough. Yeah, that was definitely a really one of my favorite episodes. I think I listened to it when I was driving back from Virginia not too long ago. Probably like 5 or 6 times. It was really easy just to listen to it, listen to some music and listen to it again because it was such a good time. And so prior to appearing on our podcast, you know, what inspired you to become an anthropologist? Like, what led you here?
That's a good question. And unlike many of my colleagues, I don't have like one of these fantastic stories of since I was 2 years old, I wanted to be an archaeologist. Like that wasn't my route getting here. Right. It was the last thing that I thought about doing. I went to school in Tennessee. Public schools in Tennessee do not have anthropology. So accidentally found anthropology as I was experimenting in college. Right. As so many other undergrads do. I was actually going to Middle Tennessee State University for a degree in aerospace and realized that that was not the path for me. I didn't realize that until, you know, like my 4th or 5th year there, and I should be finishing that degree. But I always joke, I kind of went alphabetical down the catalog of courses and departments, right? I jumped from aerospace to anthropology. And, you know, I took intro to, what was it? I think world prehistory or something like that. Thought, man, this is a pretty cool thing to talk about. And next thing I know, it's years later, and I'm out here in Colorado as a professor myself. You know, teaching intro to anthropology and intro to archaeology, and all kinds of other upper level classes as well, right? So, you know, it was just kind of one of those things where I had a basic interest in history. I had kind of an inquisitive mind, I guess, about things that I didn't know about, right? I liked trying to research things and find out about the past, about people who were here before us. And one thing, yeah, just kind of led to another. And I accidentally found my way into anthropology.
That's super cool. And I think that's one of the more interesting routes I think we've heard so far, going from aerospace to anthropology is quite the jump. I mean, you might have to calculate velocities and orbital mechanics like periodically, but that's about it. So after you finished your degree at Middle Tennessee State, you decided to continue on into higher education. What made you choose American University?
My mentor at the time, I guess. So, you know, I was finishing up my degree at MTSU. I actually ended up with a degree in anthropology and the aerospace degree, and trying to figure out, you know, what can I do with this crazy background, right? How do you make this work? And I had early on in my dabbling into archaeology at MTSU, got in touch with the folks that work at the Tennessee Division of Archaeology, specifically Aaron Dieterwolf, who, you know, has been on here before, and John Brewster as well. And so John Brewster,
I remember John.
He's this hilarious, wonderful genius, really, when it comes to archaeology and all things history. It's amazing the encyclopedic knowledge that that he walks around with. The long story short, basically, I was volunteering and interning with the people there at the Division of Archaeology in Nashville. I got really interested in stone tools and questions about antiquity of humans in the Western Hemisphere, right? Essentially, you know, who were the first Americans? And by chance, that's what John Brewster also specialized in. And so he kind of led me on the path of, you know, where he knew that people were who were studying those types of topics, suggested that maybe I look into American University because of Richard Dent, who was there, who did some work at Johnny Menasink, and just across the city over at Catholic. That's where all of the early research for the Thunderbird site had been going on. And so, yeah, just kind of thought, man, DC is a cool place to live. I wouldn't mind spending a little time there. There's a program there for me that, you know, seems like it's a good fit. I applied, miraculously got in, and yeah, that's kind of how that went.
Where did you live when you went to American University? Because that's in like Northwest, right near the cathedral.
Yeah.
Georgetown's not too far away. Like that's more expensive than Boulder.
Yeah, it's a rather affluent part of DC. I lived just a couple of blocks from the cathedral, basically kind of right between the cathedral and American University's campus in like this massive 20-story kind of condo. And yeah, just fortunately found a guy who was renting this single room, kind of, you know, just a flat that I could barely sort of afford, kind of. And yeah, made it work.
But yeah, I had a couple friends in undergrad that lived right across the street from the cathedral, and they crammed seven girls into a 3-bedroom apartment. And the only nice part about it is like the top had those patios that you had the sun chairs and everything. You just look out on DC, but it's a small apartment with a lot of women living in it.
Yeah, I know exactly those apartments that you're talking about. I had some friends that lived over there as well. And, you know, everywhere it seems like in DC has these rooftop kind of patios and great views. And, you know, for someone going to grad school, trying to figure out what they want to do, man, places like DC, you can't beat that, right? It's just the experiences that that are unachievable anywhere else. I mean, I ended up working with Dennis Stanford. He was on my master's committee. So, you know, for meeting him for research, I would just hop onto the metro, go down to the Smithsonian and go up and hang out in Dennis's office and, you know, talk about archaeology. That was, you know, something that could have never happened anywhere else.
Not a bad deal.
Yeah. Did you ever have Ben's Chili Bowl while you're in DC?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Ben's Chili Bowl. Yeah. You got to have that.
Excellent. And so your master's was public anth, right? It was a master's degree in public anthropology. what does that look like? And what kind of courses do you have to take? And like, how did they define public anthropology at American University?
To my knowledge, there are only a couple of places where you can get a degree technically in public anthropology. And as we're talking through all of this, I'm starting to see a theme emerge kind of for the first time, kind of this introspective kind of look back. But I didn't have a very traditional approach to a master's degree in public anthropology at American for a number of reasons. But, you know, in terms of what that program looks like and the courses, you know, it's really focused on social justice, on environmental justice. It's really focused on issues of race and ethnicity, resistance, those kind of topics, right? And because of that, most of the department really falls more on the cultural, sociocultural side of anthropology, right? There are actually very few archaeologists there in the department. As soon as I got there, the guy that I went to work with, Dent, immediately went on sabbatical. And so I was kind of left trying to figure out what in the world I was going to do. And there was a new faculty member, Dan Sayers, who had just started right before I got there. Dan was is a historical archaeologist. He's now the chair of the department there. And his research interest and my research interest could not be, you know, further apart. He does Maroon settlements and race and resistance kind of research. And I do Paleolithic archaeology. You know, we made it work. He was a great advisor, a great mentor. You know, I learned a lot from him. You know, I think the whole department there, including Dan, you know, it's very theoretically grounded, but it's all geared towards essentially, you know, training and producing politically active anthropologists. And, you know, if you think about in the United States, archaeology as anthropology and how political archaeology is, whether or not we mean for it to be or we want it to be, it inherently is most of the time. And so I feel like I got a really good grounding in those kinds of ideas and topics there.
Very cool. That's interesting the way they kind of meld together and they seem to work together. I've noticed at CSU, my course load was heavily sociocultural anthropology, stuff like that. It, you know, it's not straightforward how that kind of gets into your archaeological thinking, but I still think it seeps in to how I think about the past a little bit and how you like try to understand that stuff. So I think I just kind of had that connection as well, you know, thinking that that's super cool to have that as like something in your pocket to use whenever you need it.
Yeah. And, you know, if nothing else, at the very least, it forces us archaeologists to think about these really interesting sociocultural questions that are critical to our lives today, that were critical to people's lives 10,000 years ago. But as a Paleolithic archaeologist, I'm never going to find direct evidence for much of that, you know, for language, for customs, you know, for how people are interacting in that way. But nevertheless, it forces us to kind of think about that, right? And I think even just simply as thinking and considering those kinds of questions and ideas, it helps shape the way that we're interpreting the archaeological record sometimes.
I think that's really important. We kind of learned that in theory and touch on it in grad school, but like to have a whole course or a whole like program dedicated to that must be, I mean, it's relevant now for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And then you made your way to Texas A&M University, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So I left American University, finished up that master's degree. You know, I ultimately left there just because I wanted to make sure I was as rounded out, you know, academically as I possibly could be. And so I left American University to go to Texas A&M, where I was studying with Mike Waters, Ted Gable, and Kelly Graff at the Center for the Study of First Americans.
They're very nice people. I met them, I think, a few times now.
Yeah, wonderful
people. I talked to Mike. Yeah, like encyclopedic knowledge of dirt. It's pretty cool. We'll catch you guys in the next segment.
Welcome back to episode 50 of A Life in Ruins podcast. We're here with Jesse Toon. This is segment number 2. We ended the last segment kind of talking about you going to Texas A&M. I mean, we wanted to kind of expand on that a little bit. Do you mind telling us what your dissertation was on when you got there?
Sure. So I thought I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do my dissertation on. It was actually some of a holdover from my master's and thesis work, which I was promptly told at American was way too ambitious for a master's level project. Like pretty much all master's students, right? You want to go out and, you know, solve the world's problems, and that's well and fine, but you have a limited budget, a limited amount of time, and not as much training as a PhD student. So I go to Texas A&M, the Center for the Study of First Americans there. I was studying under Mike Waters. He is my main advisor. And because of my background from Tennessee and my connections with the Division of Archaeology, who had previously done work at a mastodon site in Nashville, much of my dissertation was kind of anchored by investigating and excavating, re-excavating the site called the Coates Hines Litchi site. Initially, it was called the Coates Hines site. And when we went back and re-excavated in 2012, we tacked on Litchi to the end of that to pay homage to the, at that time, current landowners who were very kind and generous to let a bunch of dirty archaeologists excavate their backyard, basically, for an entire summer. To basically kind of summarize that part of my dissertation, the Coates Hines Litchi site was initially excavated as a salvage project. It was basically a bunch of mastodon bones eroding out of natural drainage in the middle of what was going to become a subdivision, a rather upscale subdivision on the south side of Nashville. During the construction project, the Division of Archaeology got word of these mastodon bones, or these big bones anyways. And so they drive out, they take a look at it. Turns out it is mastodon. And for a couple of years, a couple of different periods of time over about 2 years, they did a salvage excavation, found some mastodon bones as well as bones of other animals and what looked like some stone tools, some undeniably, you know, legitimate stone tools, a bifacial projectile point, or at least a bifacial fragment of a tool, and then maybe some flakes as well. But there were always some questions about the context and association between those things. There were also a few radiocarbon dates that they initially got in the mid-90s that all came back calibrated about 14,000 years old. And so, you know, that's pre-Clovis by technical definition, right? So I got to Texas A&M. We decided, Mike Waters thought it was a great idea. We were going to go back and re-excavate the site, try to pull together and answer some of those questions that were outstanding, right? The context, the age, the geologic kind of setting of the site, what the actual association between the bones and the artifacts were. As it turns out, the artifacts that were recovered in the mid-90s were in a secondary context that were adjacent, nearby, very close to the mastodon bones, but were technically washed in into this drainage and were not in the same geologic deposits that these bones were actually eroding out of. However, they happen to be sitting literally right beside the bones. Geomorphology, right? Geoarchaeology, site formation is critical to these early Pleistocene sites, right? Early sites in the Americas, late Pleistocene sites. We basically spent a summer there excavating that site, reanalyzing some of the previous artifacts that were excavated, some of the bones that were excavated in the 90s, and determined that it actually was not a kill site where people were hunting mastodons 14,000 years ago. We redated all the sediment and it came back to about 30,000 years old. We found not a single thing that remotely looked like an artifact. And, you know, we're essentially able to pull this story together and show that it was completely natural, the formation of this bone bed, and then these artifacts are washing in outside of that. And so I had to do something basically with that in terms of a dissertation, and then kind of looked at long-term changes through time with how people were settling in and adapting to life in the Mid-South during the Pleistocene-Holocene transition. So I studied Cumberland bifaces and then kind of compared that to some late Paleo-Indian stuff with Dalton technology.
Cool. And then it seems like as you kind of continued through your career, you started looking at this time period in a bunch of different locations as kind of like this continuing understanding of these late Pleistocene hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, you know, so that's kind of been, you know, post-dissertation kind of really where I've gone over the last few years, right? Looking at how people adapt to new landscapes, right? How people are moving into previously unoccupied parts of the world, moving into these areas during the late terminal Pleistocene, learning new landscapes, and then sometimes having to quickly readapt because of, you know, large-scale environmental change, right? It's not just climate change, but environmental change, right? And everything that really kind of gets at, right? It's not just warming temperatures and changes in precipitation. It's also vastly different plant and animal communities, different populations of people are moving in and out that they're having to then readjust to and respond to with these population pressures. The landscape itself is changing as well, right? So yeah, that's kind of really where a lot of my work has been going these last few years.
I think that's
excellent.
Yeah, I think that stuff is super interesting. And I know David and Carlton and I have had all had conversations about like the first folks to pop in on the, in North America. How do you do that? How do you do that effectively? And how do you not die like all the early European folks who came here? You know, it's
so like kind of just talking about your research that you do, you know, today, your research and teaching interests are geographically located in U.S. Four Corners, southeastern U.S., and then also Northern Europe. So how do those geographical localities like intersect with your current research?
You know, I think you can always pick out when you're reading people's bios, right, and kind of their research interests. It doesn't matter who you're talking about. There's always kind of that oddball thing that gets thrown in there. And the chuckle there at the end, I can tell you're seeing that and going, wait, Northern Europe? What is that about? So, you know, kind of linking those all together is essentially, you know, what I was just saying. It's this idea of, you know, what are people doing at the end of the Ice Age? And as it turns out, there are a lot of similarities across the Northern Hemisphere anyways. I haven't really done anything in the Southern Hemisphere, at least yet. But yeah, across the Northern Hemisphere, we see broad similarity. And not really for any reason that these people are socially or culturally connected at all. It, in a lot of ways, it's just kind of partly random based on when people are moving into these new areas and kind of the similarities of what's happening environmentally, but also, you know, just how people were accessing resources. It's this idea of access to resources, which, you know, I'm really interested in. How do people move into a landscape, learn that landscape, learn where those resources are? You know, there's not a Pleistocene Google. You can't Pleistocene Yelp something, you know, where can I get some rock around here? Where's the best mammoth steak that, you know, you can get in town? So, you know, people who have never been to a place before got to figure out how to do it. And as it turns out, there's some similarities in that, right? We as humans, as really smart primates, think about things similarly and invent at times similar ways to deal with similar problems. And, you know, so I've moved kind of branched out from the southeastern U.S., from the mid-south into kind of the Four Corners, Colorado Plateau area, which resource-wise is night and day different compared to the southeast, right? We're talking about, you know, a hardwood forest area that's unbelievably humid with lots of precipitation and tornadoes to out here in the Colorado Plateau where it's, you know, an arid desert canyon and tableland environment. And there's not much green, you know, that there's so little humidity that most days my knuckles are cracking and bleeding because there's just no moisture in the atmosphere. But nevertheless, right, people are still having to do the same thing. They're still figuring out where to go get raw material to make tools. They're still figuring out where to go to get access to fresh water and to access information, knowledge, and partners in other social groups, right? We see similarities in how people are using the landscape in the Colorado Plateau as they were in the southeast in terms of using major waterways, rivers as kind of corridors, maybe not necessarily, you know, walking down the canyon there that the San Juan River is flowing through or the Colorado River is flowing through, but, you know, they're at least using that on the landscape as a corridor, right? You know, maybe not walking in the canyon, but, you know, beside it and following animals that are drawn to it. And, you know, kind of similar questions got me interested in Northern Europe, specifically Ireland. Ireland is an interesting case, and I'm happy to go on and on about this for quite a bit.
Sure.
We need to come back to it later. I'm happy to, but Ireland is just, you know, today about 20 kilometers away from the island of Britain. You would think they have a very similar history and ecology, but it was, you know, maybe as recent as 9,000-10,000 years ago that Britain wasn't an island. It was just a peninsula in northwestern Europe. But Ireland has always been an island.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, basically the very northwestern most extent of Europe. It's kind of out in the Atlantic, sort of by itself. It has all of this kind of leads to a very unique environmental history, very unique ecology. And there was never a time that people could just walk there. You know, it wasn't just Homo sapiens that colonized what we now, you know, think of as the British Isles or British Isle. We see Neanderthals in southern, you know, Britain well before modern humans showed up there. But that never happened in Ireland. And so I got really interested in, well, this island the size of basically the state of Indiana with a really similar population as well. What happened when people went there? How did they get there, right? Basic question of, you know, if people are going to migrate and move to an island, what do you need, right? You need a boat. And so that kind of led me down this rabbit hole of thinking about when is it ecologically viable to do that? When are people in place, in position to make that jump across with boats to the island of Ireland? And then, you know, kind of mechanically, what did that look like, right? What did that migration and local adaptations look like? And as it turns out, right, Ireland has a unique environmental history, and it also has a really unique culture history and technological history during the early Holocene compared to the rest of Europe. We see kind of a different type of toolkit showing up there that doesn't really show up at the same time in the rest of Northern Europe. And it's really because people are just adapting to that environment, right? And so these questions, right, it's this idea of adapting to new environments, it really kind of brings all of my research interests together.
Was Ireland settled like post-Neolithic, like into the Bronze Age, or was it Paleolithic?
So the earliest site in Ireland is up in Northern Ireland, at a place called Mount Sandel, and it dates to about calibrated 9,800, maybe just a little bit earlier than 9,800. So Mesolithic, and it gets into this really kind of complicated situation where in Ireland, that's early Mesolithic because it's the first Mesolithic, but in terms of gross time period, that's actually kind of middle or late Mesolithic in other parts of Europe. And so it gets really kind of complicated when you start, you know, using
sure
kind of terms. And so it's important to kind of think about the time that we're actually talking about, right? The years that we're talking about. Yeah. But basically right at during the early Holocene. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Cause people around that time start to tinker a lot more with like more complex tools and like sophisticated, you know, ways of building things. So it makes sense. They're figuring out boats and going across the I guess channel. I don't know what's right there, but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's a channel. Thank you for elucidating that. It's interesting, and I like that approach, and kind of I think Ireland seems like a cool case study. Like you said, you have this channel, you have this water barrier that's like, okay, you know, water's a channel is a big barrier in the past where we might not think of it today as such. We were really excited to ask this question of you. So in episode 37, when you were talking about the cerebral mastocyte with Dr. Shane Miller, he made an X-Files comparison between the two of you. He said that he was more of a Scully, whereas you are more like a Mulder regarding the two, like the how you guys view Paleo-Indian archaeology. What was he kind of referring to, and do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, so bringing it back to the States, right, and my work in Paleo-Indian archaeology. The first time that Shane said that, I thought, man, really? I'm Mulder? How did I get this label? If anyone's a Scully, I thought I was a Scully. But if we're really being honest about it and kind of thinking about where Shane and I fall on a lot of these questions about the timing of the first peoples in the Americas. Yeah, it's a sort of fairly accurate comparison there. Shane and I have worked together for years, and we think similarly about a lot of things. Our interpretations oftentimes are very much in line with one another, but I'm perhaps more open to the notion of early sites, pre-Clovis sites, than maybe he is, right? I don't know. Get us both back on here sometime and have us just debate this. I don't know, but...
Will do.
I think
that... Yeah, that's an idea. We're going to jot that down.
I think that the two of us work well together because of this, right? You know, that was the impetus for some of my dissertation work. I wanted to investigate proposed pre-Clovis site. And as it turned out, that didn't hold up. And it wasn't pre-Clovis. That's kind of a track record for me as well. I've investigated a number of sites that, as it turned out, they were not what they were billed to be at first.
On that note, we'll end this segment, and then we'll get back to your Darth Toon-ness. And we'll go... bon, bon, dun, 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 dun.
Awesome.
Thank you, Connor. Welcome back to episode 50 of Life Ruins Podcast. And we're here with Dr. Jesse Toon from Fort Lewis College. And so Dr. Toon, in this last segment, we kind of ended with this brief conversation about like this X-Files comparison that Dr. Miller made. And when I was making this script, I don't know X-Files, and I had to like Google what a Scully and a Mulder was so I could better ask and understand their context, because I know it conceptually. But Shane also refers to you by another name, and that is Darth Toon. what is that about?
Shane has a lot of nicknames. He came up just the other day. He swore that I was going to have a new nickname. I forgot it now. I'm sure this is something ridiculous and comical. But yeah, I have this unfortunate history of many of the sites that I've worked on. Nearly all of the early Paleo-Indian sites that I've worked on across North America have basically turned out to be something else. This whole thing started when I was, you know, working on my master's thesis, and I was supposed to be reanalyzing some prismatic blades from the site over in kind of north central Tennessee, right along the Tennessee River, called the Wells Creek Crater Site. It's actually fascinating because the site itself, the archaeological site, is sitting right on top of the central cone of an impact crater. And because of the impact that occurred, I think that one was something like 30 million years ago, it exposed all of these geologic deposits that have a lot of chert in them. And so it was this kind of natural attraction for a lot of people to show up there. And yeah, ended up analyzing these, what were supposed to be prismatic blades. And as it turns out, there was not really any prismatic blades in that assemblage. It was initially excavated and studied by a guy named Don Dragoo and published, I think, in 1968. And that was the only thing ever really written about the site. And I'm not going to say that Dragoo made everything up, but I'm not going to say that Dragoo made most things up about that site. That's a complicated and long history there, but basically that started this unfortunate chain of events for me, that site after site that I've worked at has turned out to be not really what we thought it was, right? And that, you know, followed me through my dissertation and the Coates Hines Litchi site at a few other sites since then as well. Yeah. So I suppose that's why. Sure.
People invite you that up to the sites, and then they hear about your Darth side, that and they're like, oh no, he's gonna come here, it's gonna change things. He's such a nice guy.
Just don't invite him out. We're gonna just prove our site. And you're the believer too. It's not like Dr. Miller showing up like, yeah, this site is crap. It's like you're the one that wants to believe in pre-Clovis. You come to these sites and you're like, nah, fam, this isn't what it is.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I would like to think that every time someone says, oh, actually, no, you probably shouldn't come, I would like to think that they're joking when they say that and don't really mean it. But then again, you never know, right? But I think that's really why Shane and I do work so well together, because of that Mulder Scully / Darth Toon thing. You know, as Carl Sagan said, you know, any kind of science requires this careful balance between open-mindedness for new ideas, creative thinking, but also, you know, ruthless skepticism. And that's the only way to really, you know, kind of keep the field on the right track, right? And it's a careful balance between those two things, right?
Building off this skepticism and this kind of process of science, there is this quite outstanding article that just came out fairly recently. Is this, and it's 2020, so it was last year.
Yeah, it was in the summer, summer 2020.
Yeah, and this is a site they discovered and dated to around 33,000 years calibrated, really pushing back on this earliest folks in North America, and kind of lit some fires in some places and got people going. Can you talk about the article a little bit and kind of what you think about it?
So before we can, there's the two articles. You have Ardalan et al. 2020, and then there's one that was published a little bit beforehand, and that's Becerra, Valdivia and Hingham 2020, and it's about a cave in Mexico, and I always mispronounce it. I think we talked about it briefly on the podcast over the summer because I was heated about it. Chicoahuite cave. And so this got brought up because on your CV you were talking about it, and I'm working with one of those co-authors on a different article about this, so I really wanted to get into it. So speaking of like pre-Clovis sites that might need to get shut down, here's one that you don't even need to visit the site because there's a lot of issues with the articles themselves. So why don't you go ahead and, you know, what are your thoughts and background on these articles, Dr. Toon?
Yeah, so Chicoahuite Cave is widely problematic for so many reasons. It's the newest, it's the most recent in a long line of very outlandish and grossly unsupported ideas about a pre-last glacial maximum occupation in the Americas. This is, my God, something that the archaeological community has been dealing with for decades now. And it seems like there's an increasing rate of these sites that are somehow, for no good reason, making it into publications, into scientific journals like Nature. Nature and Science, right? The most prestigious international science journals in the world. And I hope this doesn't come across as too bold, but frankly, archaeology that shows up in the journal Nature has kind of turned into a laughingstock. The review process for archaeology papers in the journal Nature has really, it's non-existent largely. And Chicoahuite, those papers related to that, I think show that, you know, it's a great example of the lack of legitimate peer review that is happening for archaeology papers anyways in the journal Nature, at least for many of them, maybe not all of them, right? There's definitely, you know, great researchers doing great work, but some of these, like Chicoahuite Cave, are just outlandish. I am somewhat involved in some things related to Chicoahuite. And I'm a little hesitant to say too much about my involvement in some of that because it's ongoing and in review kind of research. But, you know, basically there's this really high elevation cave down in central Mexico, and a group of researchers think that they have evidence for human occupation there before the last glacial maximum back, you know, the other side of 30,000 years ago. And the quote-unquote artifacts that they've pulled out of there are driveway gravel. It's a limestone cave that, you know, is occasionally collapsing. The limestone is, you know, breaking off, falling down into the cave. The cave's massive, so there's a lot of room for it to fall. And it's limestone. All of the tools, all of the purported 1,930 tools that they pulled out of that cave are made on the same limestone that the cave is made out of, at the bottom of a talus slope running down into the cave itself. Just based on that alone, there's essentially no support for these things being legitimate tools, right? I mean, I forget the exact quote in the original paper, but it, you know, it's along the lines of, well, these tools, this stone tool technology has never been identified in the Americas before anywhere. And no one recognizes it because it hasn't been found. And we're the only ones that are capable of identifying these stone tools as actual stone tools. It becomes very circular here all of a sudden, where you can't, you know, it's not a real hypothesis, right? You can't negate it if it's spun in this way, right? If they're arguing that, well, you don't recognize them because you've never seen them before, right? We're all professional archaeologists. We're all scientists and have excellent training in what a stone tool actually is, what a bifacial point actually is, right? Right. And the pictures that Absolutely. Are in that paper are just plain and simple not, you know, stone tools that we see anywhere, at least anywhere outside of Old One technology in East Africa, you know, 3 million years ago, 2.6 million years ago. So, yeah, Chicoutimi Cave has a lot of problems. There's some site formation issues going on there that were not addressed. Yeah, it's problematic.
I'm seeing some dualities between this and Cerruti, right? Like, you're talking about the geomorphology there is pretty bad, but also it's like the tool assemblage is just like what's present. And that's like the same thing with Cerruti. It's like, okay, the geomorph is off and you're telling me they butchered all this mastodon with the same stuff that these bulldozers are kicking up, like nothing non-local, you know? Because I remember this article coming out in Nature. I mean, there was nothing for... I think like publishing a controversial article like this in the summer is usually that's like the time to publish something controversial, right? All the archaeologists are out, they're in the field, no one has internet access. And then the one summer where everyone's at home and bored and pissed off for being stuck inside, you drop this in Nature and then it went everywhere. Like every archaeologist was like, not today, fam, not on my watch. So do you remember, like, you see this, I imagine it was are you subscribed to Nature, or is it just like kind of what gets posted on social media?
No, I just see archaeology stuff that comes out of that. Yeah, I don't subscribe necessarily to Nature. Yeah.
Did you was the first person you talked to, was that Dr. Miller? Did you like, hey, did you read this yet?
So I have an ongoing group text with Shane and a few other people where, you know, it's basically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, like anything outlandish and crazy archaeology. You know, it's nothing to wake up in the morning and have, you know, 75 texts from Shane at 1 o'clock in the morning because he's reading something, and I'll do the same thing, right? I don't remember exactly how it all played out immediately, but yeah, pretty much as soon as it came out, all of us were just running around with our hair on fire going, wait, is this a joke? This got published in Nature? How did this happen? Yeah.
You guys are like the Marvel superheroes, you know, work at 24/7. If the bat sign comes out there, or no. I'm DC. Sorry, DC. Yeah, if your bat sign's out there, you know, you show up and start defending. And we appreciate that.
It's less superheroes and just way more hardcore archaeology dorks about it. Yeah.
And like another problematic piece with this article, right, that we haven't touched on yet, is that they in Ardalan et al. 2020, they cite a different article written by one of the other authors, talking about how he believes that the Americas weren't inhabited by the ancestors of the indigenous North Americans, and that they're using Chicoutimi. Is anybody saying that right? Chiquita? Taquito?
I think it's Chicoutimi.
Chicoutimi.
Yeah.
The inhabitants of Chicoutimi Cave were not ancestral to indigenous North Americans, that there was another group prior to that, which has its own set of connotations that is a big no-no.
Right. This is the thing, right? We could literally spend 2 hours just talking about this one paper and this one site. And what you're getting at there is a really big deal, right? It's this idea that we're responsible for our research, for our data, and the implications of that, right? We're producing information and knowledge that can then get skewed and misappropriated to to mean different things, right? And yeah, so not in the paper itself, I believe, but in some interviews related to it, the authors for the Chiquiti Cave paper say that the inhabitants, these pre-LGM inhabitants of the cave, were not related to modern day Native Americans. And that's wildly problematic for so many reasons. And it doesn't fit with any of the other data, any types of data that we know about, right? Genetically, archaeologically, environmentally, right? When we're talking about when you could actually migrate into the Americas, none of this lines up. And to say that there's this mysterious group of people that lived in a cave for 20,000 years, made a technology, a stone tool technology that has never been seen before or since. It remained unchanged for those 20,000 years. And then they just disappeared. That is tough to get your head around, right? That doesn't hold up logically when we start thinking about the rest of North American archaeology.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to have you come back on with Shane, and we can talk more in depth about this article. Because that Cerruti site, Settlers of Cerruti, as it was dubbed,
oh, right, yeah,
is one of our most popular episodes so far, and I've gotten really good reviews, and people really liked yours and Dr. Miller's conversation. So, you know, before we end the show, Dr. Toon, what are a couple sources that you'd recommend for anyone interested in, early Paleo-Indian archaeology?
Yeah, so, you know, early Paleo-Indian archaeology, I think anyone who's interested in this, a good starting point is David Meltzer's First Peoples in a New World, Colonizing Ice Age America. I use it in my Ice Age North America class. It's, you know, easy, approachable, and fairly up to date. It's a few years old now, and so some things are changing. But, you know, start there, go over to Mercy Rockman and James Steele's book, The Colonization of Unfamiliar Landscapes, The Archaeology of Adaptation. It's a go-to. It's one of my favorites, right? It really gets at the heart of a lot of these questions about what do people do when they move into a place that people have never been before, right? What is, you know, this idea of colonization processes that we see people going through again and again at the end of the Pleistocene around the world, right? Yeah. So, you know, if we're talking about archaeology of early Paleo-Indians and migrations, those are kind of two of my favorites.
Cool. First Peoples has some awesome pictures in it too. It's a cool looking book.
Yeah,
yes. It does. Mm-hmm. That's a good like coffee table book. If you want to impress people, like you're an intellectual, get that book and set it on that coffee table.
So Dr. Toon, where can people find you on social media or like academia websites?
So on Twitter is kind of my research Twitter handle is just JW Toon.
Okay.
Twitter. And then you know, I have a website for the lab, the Hunter Gatherer Research Collaborative in Lab, the Hunger Collab, as it's called. That's a webpage on Weebly. I don't know, maybe we can link to that or something.
Yeah, we'll drop all that in the show notes and cool. on our social media post. We'll put those in there.
Awesome.
So thank you so much for being on. Since this is your second time on this, no, your second first time on this, we usually ask this question about like, ultimately, would you choose to be Darth Toon and change archaeology and be awesome again?
Yeah, you know, I have no qualms about the path that I took to get here and would happily do it again. Yeah.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, with that, we just interviewed Dr. Jesse Toon, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Fort Lewis College. You can find him on Twitter at JW Toon.
Please be sure to give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you find it, or send us another email, hopefully a polite one. It'd be great. We need to get some feedback on what we're doing. It'd be great.
And with that, we are out. Thanks for listening to A Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer. So the difference between a numerator and a denominator is a short line. Only a fraction of people will understand this.
Thank you, Dean. Is that from Dean?
That's that Dean. Dean joke? That's on the Dean website joke.
Excellent. Thank you, Connor. And with that, we're really out.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.